Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to another episode of So I Married a Horror Fan. We are now in April, which is madness because it was Christmas a week ago. I don't understand how it is fucking April.
I don't think anyone does, babe.
But here we are. It's the first episode for April. We are kicking off the month of April, which is Lee's month.
It is indeed.
With episode number 165. Oh, did I say my name? I'm Simon. I'm one of your co-hosts.
And I'm Lee.
And we are kicking off our April programming with episode number 165. Do you know, out of the films that you picked, this is the only one of two that I've heard of?
Yeah.
Well, no, because I've heard of Bad Samaritan. I guess actually scrap that because I've heard of Bad Samaritan, but I've never heard of Double Date. So I don't know what the fuck that Double Date movie is going to be like.
Neither do I, but we'll find out together.
Yay! So yeah, we are kicking off today with an episode on Attack the Block. I don't know if this is a horror movie or not.
I mean...
Also, why is this movie called Attack the Block and not Class War of the Worlds?
You're proud of that one, aren't you?
I am. I think it's good. Dramatic pause while Lee does something.
I'm just getting up the page.
Yeah, that's what I was waiting for you to do.
Well, you didn't say now to Lee's bit, so I was waiting for you to, Lee's going to do her stuff, which is what you normally say. But, yeah.
Lee's going to do her stuff, which is what I normally say.
Oh, it's going to be one of those fucking episodes. I can feel it in my bones. Okay, so Attack the Block released in 2011.
Mate.
No, written and directed by Joe Cornish, who is a bit of a British icon.
I don't really know much that he's done outside of the Adam and Joe show, which is him and Adam Buxton, right?
Yeah. He did the Adam and Joe show. He wrote the screenplay for Adventures of Tintin. He wrote the screenplay for Ant-Man. A screenplay by him, though.
Mm-mm. The Ant-Man thing is complicated. We don't talk about
it. Okay, fine. He wrote The Kid Who Would Be King.
Okay.
And he also adapted and wrote Lockwood & Co.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as we all know, I quite like.
Yeah, basically, he wrote a screenplay with Edgar Wright for Ant-Man when Edgar Wright was due to direct Ant-Man. But then when they got shit-canned and they hired other writers before they hired whoever it is that fucking directed those Ant-Man movies, they still use, some of the story elements, so they have a story by credit, both of them, but they didn't actually, write the film. I just think they used some of the story elements.
Screenplay by him and Edgar Wright have got.
Yeah, because I think they used, enough of it that they had to get, a screenplay credit. Because I think it was Edgar Wright's idea to have...
Yeah, so they've got screenplay and story by credits, mm-hmm. And I'm assuming Adam McKay wrote.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have a story by credit, he literally has a screenplay credit.
Because I think Edgar Wright came up with the story, because he wanted Ant-Man to be... I can't even think of the fucking character. Scott, whoever the fuck
Lang.
It is. Lang, yeah. I think he was the one who chose that Ant-Man and that story. It was a very messy and very complicated thing, but they got shit canned from the film basically.
Well, I'm still claiming it for them because they got screenplay and story credits.
I mean, they got some Marvel money. let's put it that way.
Let's be fair, they probably deserved it.
I feel like Luis was definitely an Edgar Wright creation.
Oh, 110%. There is no way Luis was not created by Edgar Wright.
And I feel like if Edgar Wright had directed this, Scott Lang's mates, Luis, and fucking, who's the other guy? It's David DeSmalchian and T.I., or his other two mates. I feel like those would have quite, not T.I. obviously, but I feel like the other two probably would have been some combination of Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yeah.
Or other people he's worked with. I hilariously think that Luis could have quite easily been played by Michael Cera. Because he's got that weird manic energy.
Have you seen the fucking John Cera adverts for Cera V?
Who the fuck is John Cera?
Oh,
he super bad.
Fucking.
Yes, they showed them at the Super Bowl, and it's like the aging cream.
They wish it was just a body cream, really. It's exciting. Right, casting wise for this. So we've got Jodie Whittaker as Sam, John Boyega as Moses in his first film.
Yeah.
Alex Esmail as Pest, Leon Jones as Jerome, Franz Drammer as Dennis, Simon Howard as Biggs. You got Daniela Vitalis as Tia and Paige Mead as Dimples, who are the two main girls. And then we have Michael Ajao as Mayhem, Sammy Williams as Probs, Luke Treadway as Brewis. I didn't realise his name was Brewis. That's delightful.
Yeah, they say it like three times.
I know, but it hadn't got into my brain. Nick Frost as Ron, Jermaine Hunter as Hi-Hats, and Salom Awadzi, it's a fucking name for me to get out, as Tonks. And then outside of that, I mean...
Does Tonks die off screen?
No.
Is he the guy that gets his throat ripped out?
Yeah.
So he's not the guy that has a load of build up in the book and then his death gets really, really swept under the rug in the film adaptation, no?
What?
That joke will land later and you'll laugh. When you realise what his character name is and what I've just said.
No, I know exactly what you're on about. You know there's no build up in the book to her death whatsoever.
I don't know.
They die off screen in both, but there's more build up of their characters in the books.
Lol.
Yeah, we don't talk about those films.
Do, 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 do. John Cera.
Shut up. As this film was made on an estimated budget of $13 million. I'm not entirely sure it's true because that's a film for film. I don't think they've ever given anyone that much money.
Yeah, it's probably lottery funded as well.
Yeah, lottery funded, that is true. And apparently, Grace Worldwide, it made $6
million. Yeah, because the thing is, like, it's weird, because I don't really know what, like, the laws around, like, filming in certain places are. Mm. Especially with, like, council estates and stuff like that. Because, without sounding like a prick, and with the best will in the world, like, they're not really a high priority for, like...
I think a lot of stuff like this gets filmed in, like, old abandoned ones.
Mm-hmm. And also, you would have to be, like, genuinely worried about, like, actual
crime.
IRL versions of the kids that are in this movie.
And then the plot of this movie is a teen gang in South London defend their block from an alien invasion. Which is pretty... That's basically the plot of this film. Mm-hmm.
All I've learned from watching this movie and watching a lot of movies set in these specific parts of London is that every fucking block of flats looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
Because this film, the setting of this film and the park that it's like set in, the area, looks exactly like the part of Elephant and Castle that Harry Brown is set in, that then also looks like the same.
Thing is they do... And you are right, they all do basically look the same. That's because they were all basically built at the exact same time to basically be treated as, like, this, for, like, American listeners, the slums.
Mm-hmm. Some real District 9 shit.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as well, like, it's kind of one of those, like, it's one of those weird things because, like, obviously, like, we'll talk about it a little bit later. Obviously, there is, like, a class thing going on in this. There's a class and a race thing going on in this movie, very, very obviously. But, like, the thing that I find really fascinating about what I just said about the blocks of flats and stuff is the blocks of flats. So, Harry Brown is filmed in Elephant and Castle, which is the, like, estate where Michael Caine grew up. And it's kind of a very similar story. It's all about, like, gangs and hoodlums and shit. And that looks exactly the same as the block of flats and the area that's in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I find it really funny that, obviously, they build these blocks of flats that are, like, basically pop-up blocks. So they put, like... all of the displaced, what they would class as, like, displaced people there. So they put people on, like, benefits, people that are, like, on low-income housing, like, blah, 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 in these areas.
What's really hilarious is, this was filmed at Highgate Estate in Elephant Castle.
Yeah, which is probably the same estate that they filmed
probably
Harry Brown on.
Probably is.
So
it was filmed at Highgate Estate in Elephant Castle, at Mitre's Field in Brixton, the Oval Underground Station, mm-hmm. and the Merton Estate in Islington. Yeah.
But what the point I was trying to make is they make these really nondescript looking like fucking blocks of flats. And they like try to do it so that like they just basically, like you said, they put all the, like, the displaced people there, or the people that they don't really have any time for. But then you go to, like, really fucking posh parts of London, and, like, all of the really high-end, like, housing areas all look the fucking same as well. And it's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, because where was it we stayed? Was it Hyde? It wasn't Hyde Park, was it? It wasn't Hyde Park. Where the fuck was it we stayed?
Notting Hill.
That section of Notting Hill where we stayed in, all of those flats looked exactly the same. And I'm like, you are like one coat of paint and a more secure fence away from looking exactly the same as, like, the area of people that you look down on.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of fascinating to me that, like, you know, people with money are like, oh no, I couldn't go live in, like, a council estate because it's all just, like, nondescript blocks of flats. And I'm like, motherfucker, you live in just a slightly nicer version of this and you're paying through the arse for it. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Like, but I digress. That was a weird tangent to go on. So this was your choice. So talk to me about Attack the Block.
It was. So Attack the Block's one of those films. Like, I quite like a British film. I think there's something... Being British, obviously, in case you didn't know this, shock horror, we are indeed English.
Not Australian, which you have been accused of being.
Have we been accused of being an Aussies?
I think so, yeah.
Jesus.
Which is weird, because England, America, and Australia are, like, our three biggest markets.
So I'm quite a big fan of films set in England, partially because, obviously, I am English, but also because, realistically, we don't have that big of a market in films. Especially kind of actual big money films. Mm-hmm. It's got better over the past, like, 10 years or so, but we're still quite a small market. And there's something nice about seeing areas and locations that, like, you're like, oh yeah, like, I understand what's happening because I know that kind of area. I know the kind of people who live there. Like, I've been somewhere like that. Like, when I went to London not that long ago, and I went to... Where was I? When I went to go to the play...
Oh, you went to Finsbury Park.
Finsbury Park. And I walked through basically an estate very similar to this to get to the theatre.
I'm glad I'm just hearing about this now.
In the daylight, though. That's fine.
Crime happens in the daylight. Crime happens in the
day. It was really busy. It wasn't like it was quiet. But, like, because so, like, it's somewhere like I'm... Well, I've been to places like that. And the thing is I do feel like estates like this as well, and not specifically a London thing. Like, I grew up in quite a poor area.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone who isn't aware at this point, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned it before, like, I grew up in South Yorkshire, which is a lot of, like, old mining towns, old steel places and things like that. So there's a lot of estates. You go to Sheffield, there's a lot of, like, the tower blocks as well. But most city centres, I grew up in mining towns, so I grew up in really small villages. But it's something that's intrinsic to me because I know those places. Mm-hmm. And Attack the Block is one of those films that I do really fucking enjoy.
Mm.
Yeah, that's why I picked it. Also, I did want to kind of stick to... I wanted my month to be kind of like British movies, or as much as, like, I could.
British co-productions as well.
British co-productions, yeah. Or British films. Because I just feel like... We've got some foot in horror, but I don't think we get a lot of love or respect over here for our horror films all that much.
Yeah, I personally don't think if Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz hadn't been such big hits, I don't think this movie would have been made. I also think, like, culturally, that the film, it's really fascinating to me, and I don't know how much thought actually went into this. Please excuse me while I kind of explain my train of thought on this one. I find this film's release in the time in history when it came out to be absolutely fascinating. And I think the only two times in history this movie... Well, in the last 15 years, the only two times this film could have been released is the time that it was released when it came out, and probably now, for it being like having the most impact. So there was a spate of films... In, I think, probably like the mid-2000s. So we're going probably from like 2006 to like 2013. In that kind of like 8-year window, there was a lot of like what was labelled like hoodie horror. And it was like, you know, newspapers in this country, like The Sun, The Daily Mail, basically newspapers that are run by
the tabloid,
conservative-leaning tabloid media moguls,
or just twats.
Yeah, basically people that just want to like scaremonger and like, you know, will print any old shit to push an agenda. They basically had dubbed, like, there was a hoodie problem in this country because, like, kids in tracksuits, kids in hoodies with, like, scarves and stuff like that covering their faces. A lot of gangs. And it's, like, all over the country, like, there are gangs of kids like that in the area where we live. Like, there are some of them that live on our street, like, or around the corner from us. And
I know exactly the group you're on about,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. And, like, it is, like, as somebody who just, you know, you never really know what someone's intentions are, especially when you can't see their face. Like, it is kind of a scary thought to be, like, walking home and be confronted with a group of these kids, or teenagers, or adults, or whatever it is. And there was a whole spate during that, like, 7-year window. You had films like Eden Lake, Harry Brown, the one that Plan B made, Ill Manners.
You also had, on the other hand, of not just horror, we had, like, adulthood, kidulthood.
Yeah, yeah, because, like, the Plan B one, Ill Manners, and Harry Brown aren't so much horror movies. But they were like these sensationalised films that were like painting a picture of like a broken Britain. And it was like, you know, especially on the run-up to like the 2012 Olympics, because there was a lot of like concerns for people's safety, like when we hosted the Olympics in 2012. And like there was a lot of concern over the rise of like hooded gangs, like attacking people, mugging people, like coming from these poor estates. Like, for any of you that don't know what the term chav means, like a chav is essentially like how the kids would be portrayed in this. And it stands, like, the acronym stands for council housed and violent, which is a big thing that Plan B calls out in the song Ill Manners from the soundtrack of the film. And it was kind of fascinating to like watch these films and watch like the world melt down. And, like, have this kind of, like, because usually people, especially people, like, outside of the UK, have this kind of impression of us as a bunch of royalist fucking tea and crumpet football watching fucking pricks. And to see the world melt down and freak out over the idea of, like, coming here and, like, being concerned that they were going to get stabbed or mugged or, like, have their houses broken into because of, like, the sensationalisation of, like, media and, like, how well some of these films are portrayed. Like, there's a film that came out that Nick Love made called Outlaw, which is about, like, basically, it's set in South London and it's about crime and how all the police are being paid off to turn a blind eye. Mm-hmm. And Danny Dyer, basically, him and Sean Bean form a vigilante group so they can fight back. And it's all just people that have, like, been mugged or felt helpless and stuff. And then to kind of see this film come out in the midst of all of that and then kind of paint this portrayal of these kids as heroes is really fascinating, because as somebody that lives in this country, and maybe I'm gonna have to admit to maybe checking my privilege here, like, I am someone that would be classed as middle class because mm-hmm. my family aren't rich, my family aren't poor, but I'm considered well educated and I live in a nice house, and like, you know, I've never really had to struggle for anything. But at the same time, I live in a city that is half people like me and then half people that are like the kids that are portrayed in this. People that are violent, people that are struggling, people that are poor, people that like are on the poverty line, that are resorting to crime. Some people do it because they're trying to survive. Some people do it because they come from like generations of like violent families, and that's kind of, violence is all they know. But that doesn't make it any less scary when you're someone walking down the street and you're confronted with these kids and you don't know if they are going to move out of your way or if five of them are all about to kick your head in, which is kind of why I've always struggled watching this film.
So, interestingly enough, saying about that, this film came about because of an actual mugging.
Mm.
So,
did Joe Cornish get mugged?
Joe Cornish got mugged by a gang of youths in South London. They stole his wallet and his watch.
Nice.
And that was kind of, like, 10 years before the film happened, but it was like it never really left me. And that's where the opening of this film comes from, and, like, that kind of fear of, like, something like that happening. And I feel like it's quite interesting to see a character like Jodie Whittaker's character in this, because Jodie Whittaker is not the kind of person you would normally find,
yeah, living in the ends.
Living in the ends.
Yeah.
obviously she's there because she's a student nurse. It's cheap rent because people don't really want to live there.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I do love about this film is because you see a lot of these movies where it deals with like the hoodlum problems and things like that. And they're all like, oh yeah, they're just a bunch of chavos. They're all like absolute dickheads. Like they'll stab you as soon as look at you. But they never really address the fact that a lot of these youths and these gangs are like children who basically their option is poverty.
Yeah.
Or joining a gang or trying to break out on their own.
Yeah.
Like they don't really have that many options. And I think that's a really great thing this film does, is because it doesn't really address, you know, they're all kids because some of them are very young looking.
Probs and Mayhem are like Probs and Mayhem nine, are like
9 years old.
Yeah.
But even the other kids are like, I forgot all of their names.
Yeah, well,
Moses.
Moses is like 15.
But the thing is what I was saying is you can tell all the time.
Yeah.
John Boyega at the time this was made was like 18, 19 years old. So he looks a lot older anyway. But a lot of the kids were, you know, between the ages of like 17 to 19,
mm-hmm.
portraying like 14, 15 year olds, which is pretty standard fare. But you don't really question, you assume John Boyega's character is slightly older because he holds himself a lot more like an adult. Whereas you know the others are kind of younger because they say shit that you're like, oh yeah, you're a fucking kid. Like, that's the dumbest shit.
You're a fucking idiot. Whereas
Moses kind of, he's the leader of the gang and he's quite stoic. And it's only at the very end of the film when Jodie Whittaker says to him, like, how old are you?
Yeah, because she goes into like, his bedroom and sees like,
he's the Spider-Man bed covers and the pizza boxes everywhere because his uncle's not really around. He's basically been taking care of himself for God knows how long.
Yeah.
Which is kind of hinted at the beginning of the film when you see all of the other kids going into their apartments to go get everything, their flats, and they're like talking to their mums, their dads, like
Nans.
Their nan. And then when you get to John Boyega's flat, he comes to the door, he opens the door and slams it, and you don't enter the flat at all. And he's basically been raising himself and also trying to keep all of the kids he hangs out with mostly out of trouble and out of the view of Hi-Hat as well, who's like kind of the gang leader of the ends.
Yeah.
Because he seems to be taking on everything from him, try and protect the other kids from it being them.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting look because you also assume watching the film, oh, John Boyega's like one of their older brothers, like he's slightly older, he's like 19, lives on his own. He's like he's not an adult, but he's like he's a grown-ish person. He's not really an adult, but. And then it's at the end of the film when he's like, oh yeah, I'm 15. And you have the same realisation as Jodie Whittaker of like, you thought he was older. Because that's what she says. She's like, I definitely thought you were older than that. No, she says
you look older.
You look older than that.
Yeah.
And I do think it's a thing where a lot of films that deal with kind of the gangs in South London, like, you know, the hoodie problem. I don't want to call it a hoodie problem because it was never really a fucking hoodie problem. It was just sensationalised media.
Mm-hmm.
It's often not addressed that these are kids who have nothing else. They can't, there's not a way out of there for them.
Yeah.
And there's a few lines in this film that really do address that as well. I think this is part of the reason that I do love this film so much because at the end of the day, it's an alien invasion flick. With I think it's got enough horror elements to be called a horror movie because those monsters are fucking creepy as fuck.
There's some good gore in it.
But like but at the same time, it's making this commentary on, you know, the treatment of, like, estate kids, the fact that they're just shoved there. There's multiple comments. There's one point where Jodie Whittaker is like, we'll just call the police. Like, I'll tell them what happened. And they're all like, yeah, we're black kids from, like, the estate.
Except Pest, who's not.
Except Pest. But Pest's an estate kid. He's grown up basically knowing the police come, you're the one who's getting in trouble.
Yeah. Like, don't tell.
Don't tell anyone because the cops will arrest you before they actually look for anybody. And it's like one of those horrifying realizations. Yeah, that's true. Like, if anything happens near an estate in London, the first thing they do is go to the estate and arrest more than likely the black youths of the estate.
Yeah.
And pull them in for questioning. Irregardless of if the crime had anything to do with the estate at all, the first thing the police will do is go, oh, well, we're, like, 2 minutes down the road from an estate.
It's a lot of, like, racial profiling.
And the thing is, though, part of me feels like it's not even just racial. It's just you're an estate kid.
Yeah.
You could be white, black.
Well, I say it's racial profiling because John Boyega's character, Moses, makes that. He has that, like, monologue during the film when he says, like, it wouldn't surprise me if the government didn't breed these things to hunt black kids. He said first it was the drugs,
then it was the guns.
Then it was the guns.
And we weren't killing each other fast enough.
He's like, so they decided to speed up the process. Which is kind of like a sad realisation. Like, this is the one thing that the film does really well. Like, you know, these kids, like, when you meet these kids in the beginning of the film, these kids are, like, quite scary. They're quite formidable because, you know, we've all come across a gang like that. You know, we've all kind of wondered how this is going to go, which way this is going to go. And, you know, even now, like, you know, living in the area that we live in, like, it's still a constant thing of, like, if you see two or more kids in those, like, fucking jackets or, like, with a thing over their face, you're just like, oh, shit, like, what the fuck is going to happen, like, now? And it's kind of interesting the way that, like, the film goes out of its way to kind of make you see them as people. Mm-hmm. And, like, I've only seen this movie a couple of times, and, like, I always struggle, like, trying to root for... Like, I find it hard to root for the kids in this movie for about the first hour of this film, because I'm just like, there's no part of me, like Jodie Whittaker's character, that, like, anything that happens now, like, you can save us from an alien invasion, any of this, like, it doesn't take away what you did, and it doesn't take away what you've done and what you have been doing. But it does a really good job of kind of, like, playing on that kind of, like, ripping open that kind of, like, class system in the UK and kind of, like, the sensationalism of, like, you know, it's easier for the fucking newspapers to turn around and go, oh, these kids are fucking criminals, they're, like, low IQ idiots who are just causing crime, rather than going, but why aren't they getting, like, youth programs, why aren't they getting funding, why aren't they getting better education, why aren't they getting help and support, why is our crooked fucking government siphoning money off to put in its own fucking pockets and to sort their own fucking mates out rather than actually looking at helping, like, everybody in that, you know.
Do you know what I find really interesting about this film, though? It's because, like you said, it's really hard to sympathise with the kids. I've seen this movie enough times now that my immediate reaction is the first time you meet them is, like, they're kind of... I'm never annoyed at what they do because I'm like, I get it already. But I remember the first time seeing this, and I had a conversation with one of my friends. This was years back. It's really gonna start with me because they were saying, you know, like, gangs of kids like that is terrifying. And my brain was like, if I saw that group of kids, I'd probably be way less weary than if I saw what in my head. And I do feel like it's part of where I'm from. So I grew up in a manning town in Yorkshire. We were a primarily white community.
I've got a drink. Please mention the manning town in Yorkshire.
Manning town in Yorkshire. But no, like, we were a primarily white community. It was very rare. And until I came to school here...
Mate, I've been to where you come from 3 times now, and I've never seen a single black person or Asian person.
We had a, like, there was a couple of Asian people. There was two Asian people in my school while I was there.
Oh no, fucking tell a lie. I saw a black person when we went to your nan's funeral because your fucking uncle's black.
My uncle, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, my bad. I was like,
but you know what? I mean, but they're from Birmingham. They're not from where we're from.
Yeah.
They're Brummies. But like, it would be like, so when this movie came out and everyone was like, I remember saying, like, oh, big gangs of black youths like that, it's slightly terrifying. And I was like, I'd be way more scared of a fucking gang of white kids because I've seen what those fuckers can do.
Yeah.
I've walked through an estate in Yorkshire in the dark. It's terrifying. Even now, to this day, it still fucking terrifies me. Like, I'm a woman in my 30s. I would not walk through the council estate in the village I grew up from.
Yeah.
No way on planet. But I kind of remember moving here and it was the first time that I'd kind of witnessed that kind of, oh, like, no, that's they're estate kids. And I was like, I remember the first time I said to him, I was like, but they don't look like estate kids.
Yeah.
Because to me, estate kids are a bunch of skinny white chavos who think they're hard. They're not. They're just dickheads. And it's weird because, like, the kids at the group of youths on our road who, for the first year or so we lived here, I were terrified of. like, properly scared of. And, like, now we've lived here long enough that I've interacted with them a few times. They are a perfectly nice bunch of lads. But they look fucking terrifying when they're all together. There's about 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
They congregate outside one of the houses. They've got bikes recently as well. They've all got mopeds now.
Yeah, one of the little fuckers had an electric scooter for a while.
Yeah, I think two or three of them have got mopeds now because they were all outside with the mopeds today. I think, no, yesterday when I was driving home. And but they're, like, perfectly lovely. But, yeah, like, and it's weird because movies like this make me look at stuff like that. Like, I was instinctively scared of them. But I'm like, but why?
Mm.
But then I'm like, because the newspapers, I don't read the news anymore. Like, I purposefully avoid it. But the newspapers scared me for a really long time into thinking any group of kids were dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, now, even walking through town, broad daylight, if a group of kids walk towards me, I'll move out of the way.
I think also, like, social media hasn't helped. Like, since this movie came out, like, the rise in social media in the last 13 years, where everything's on TikTok or Instagram, you know, like, you see, like, they're called roadmen now, aren't they?
Yeah, roadmen.
Like, you see them, like, filming their drill videos, or, like, you know, that was another big thing when this came out. Like, this was, like, this was around the time when video phones started coming out.
Wasn't this around about the time Happy Slapping?
Yeah, like it became a big thing for, like, gangs to, like, beat people up and then film it on their phones and, like, share the footage around. And then obviously that stuff doesn't happen as much now, but, like, obviously, like, you see stuff still on TikTok, you see stuff on Instagram, like, which is weird. You can't see a fucking pair of tits on Instagram or a dick, but you can see, like, somebody being, like, violently assaulted. And, like, this has become one of the things, like, this is one of the most fascinating things about our culture now, is, like, the media almost doesn't really have to do their job anymore, because the minute a crime takes place or the minute an assault takes place, you've got, like, 40 people there already ready with their phones out, ready to post it on Instagram, post it on Facebook. You have, like, fucking groups dedicated to this shit. You have, like... But this isn't just a UK-based thing. This is a worldwide thing.
Yeah, it's a worldwide thing.
Like, the amount of videos I see of, like... You know,
isn't that what World Star was?
I think so, yeah. Because there was that video from the Waffle House a few months ago where the fucking people started a riot in the Waffle House and that fucking employee caught the chair and fucking lobbed it at someone's head. But, like, this is the thing, like, and I think, again, like, you know, this is part of the thing of, like, you know, why everybody is kind of afraid to leave their houses a little bit is because, you know, it's just, it's so, people are so nonchalant nowadays. People just don't really care about stuff. People are like, you know, people are like, I'll go and fucking rob a Tesco at 7 o'clock in the morning and just walk out and, like, people...
I was in a fucking Farm Foods literally yesterday.
Yeah.
And two birds just straight up.
Seagulls. Two women.
Two seagulls. I mean, to be fair, Pompey seagulls, you never fucking know. Two women literally walked down one aisle, picked up, like, an armload of stuff and just walked out.
Yeah.
Like, and me and the cashier were both just watching them, like, that was fucking ballsy.
And,
like,
the thing is, it feeds into what we're saying, because... There is a council estate literally behind that Farm Foods.
There is a council estate literally behind that Farm Foods. There's also a tower block behind that Farm Foods as well.
Yeah. And I think weirdly, like...
And funnily enough, as I left Farm Foods, I was parked at the back where the estate is.
And they were walking towards the estate.
I see them walking into the estate.
But, like, I think there's no bigger indication of, like, what John Boyega is saying, what his character Moses is saying in this film. And, like, I really don't want to kick a hornet's nest and I don't really want to get into a debate about it. But the Grenfell Tower situation is kind of the biggest indication of what our government in this country thinks of people that they consider to be lesser than them. And that's all I'm going to say on that subject.
If you don't know what it is, Google
that incident.
Well, don't, unless you want to be made exceedingly angry. Because it's not just the incident, it's the amount of denial and pushback and delaying they did after it happened.
And, like, the thing is as well, like, I think that's why the ending of this movie is so interesting. Like, because Moses and his friends ultimately save their tower block and their, like, estate from an alien invasion, single-handedly, like, five kids and a couple of, like, hangers-on. Essentially... I
mean, basically, the five kids and Jodie Whittaker. No one else really does.
Ron kind of comes in and out. Brewis kind of comes in and out. And then, like, Hi-Hat and all that lot. Like, there's a few other peripheral characters, but, like, nobody outside of the estate really knows what's going on. Mm. Which I find to be fascinating. Like, I would like to know what every other fucker in London's doing at this point.
Well,
but
the attack is basically directed contained. At the estate, isn't
but
it?
I find it fascinating that, like, these kids die, or and the remaining ones save the estate from these aliens, yet they still end up in handcuffs, which to me kind of suggests, like, it doesn't matter
what
you
they do.
Like, there is a systemic thing in society, and whether it's a good or a bad thing, like, I don't really want to get into, like, cancel culture and all that sort of stuff, but there seems to be a thing, like, in society at large, if somebody does something bad in their life or has a series of bad things that they commit, whether it's a crime or whatever, we as a society have officially deemed that person to be a write-off.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot be redeemed. They cannot do anything. They cannot apologise. They cannot come back for it. Like, you see this with celebrities a lot. I mean, I don't really know what it's like in the real world, because cancel culture kind of doesn't really exist in the real world. It kind of, unless it's on a level like this, when it comes to, like, employment and things like that, and not being deemed worthy of getting out of the place that you came from. Like, mm-hmm. someone's always going to have a fucking boot on your neck, essentially. And, like, I do find it fascinating that, like, again, this is something that's happened in the last decade. Like, people in society are like, you know, you'll never get another situation like Robert Downey Jr. Like, mm-hmm. you'll never get another situation where an actor is allowed to do that, where mm-hmm. an actor is allowed to come back and have an amazing career. And that, to me, I think, is the most fascinating thing about the end of this film, is the look on Moses' face when he's led out of that tower block. He knows what he did. He knows who he is. And he knows how much that means to the people of that block, that he has essentially saved all of those families and all those people. But in the eyes of the law, he is always going to be and always will be a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so fucking fascinating.
See, I think that's one of my favourite things about the end of this film, is it's not just that. So there's a couple of moments in the lead up to the end that kind of really drive home kind of the council estate culture and the tower block culture. Because there's a conversation, it's between Moses and Jodie's character.
Sam.
Where he basically says, I didn't know you lived here. If I'd have known you lived here, we would have never stepped to you.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't step to somebody from your block.
Yeah.
Ever. Like, that's...
Yeah.
You wouldn't do that, because they live in the same yeah. building as you. They're the same kind of people.
They're the people that you have to have your own back, because nobody outside of this estate
exactly.
is going to have your back.
And then, obviously, so with the robbery at the beginning, Jodie had gone to the police, Sam had gone to the police. Points the finger at Moses earlier in the film, which leads to two cops dying. But then at the end of the film, when he's being led out in handcuffs, the police go, oh, are those the kids who attacked you? And Sam turns around and she's like, no, those are the ones who saved me.
Mm.
Like, she does a full roundabout turn from the beginning of the film. I mean, obviously, she survived an alien invasion. Quite literally, Moses did save her life. But you can see her face when Moses falls from the balcony and she's, like, terrified that he's died. Because she's become attached to these children at this point, and especially now she realises that they are just kids.
Yeah.
Especially Moses, because he's had to grow up way too quickly.
Yeah.
And take care of himself, and, like, he's still got Spider-Man bedding. Like,
yeah.
He's a kid. And then the very ending where the entire block are shouting Moses' name. Because his little smile at the end is, I think, one of my favourite closing moments in a film, mm-hmm. when he goes... Because at the end of the day, I think at this point he's fully aware he's probably going to go down for it, regardless of whether or not
yeah.
he did anything.
Well, he can't afford a lawyer.
But he knows that the block knows what he did, and that's all
yeah.
that really matters to
yeah.
him. But to be fair, because the thing is, oh my God, what are the girls called? Dimple and...
Tia.
Because Tia literally says, like, we'll get you somebody, like, we'll get money together, we'll get you out of this.
We'll start GoFundMe for, like,
yeah.
legal services.
And the thing is, as well, is I think with, like, having Sam on side of her being like, no, they saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really horrible thing to say, but they've got a white woman, a white nurse, basically going, no, these kids, they saved my life tonight.
Yeah.
Because more than likely what will happen is Hi-Hat will take the fall, because Hi-Hat's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's a prick.
And he's a prick.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it couldn't have happened to a nicer asshole, because he's a proper cunt.
But, like, it is a fascinating film, and I think that's part of the reason why, like, aside from all the stupid bollocks that happens in this movie, like, aside from, like, the alien invasion angle and, like, you know, all of the keenly observed, like, teen behaviour and stuff like that, like, it does have an incredible amount to say, and I think that's part of the reason why, for a whole lot of people, like, that film holds up.
Yeah.
I'd be fascinated to know, though, how this movie plays in other parts of the world. Like, not places like America and stuff like that, where they have gangs and gang crime and stuff. But, like, I'd be fascinated to know, like, where this culture doesn't exist in the world. How this movie plays for people like that.
I feel like it exists everywhere. It depends on how prevalent it is.
Yeah.
One thing I do love about this film, though, because teen vernacular is constantly changing, but specifically London estate vernacular is very specific. The way they walk to, like, phrase their words, the way they build their sentences, the kind of terms they'll use, is very specific to specifically that part of South London.
Mm-hmm.
And you will hear people talk about this if ever you, like, especially people who are from South London who become actors, like, they have their own vernacular,
mm-hmm.
and it's their own language, basically. So when they were writing this film,
they got James Acaster, because he knows a thing or two about London postcodes.
He does know a thing or two about London postcodes, SW9. for fuck's sake. No, the director, writer...
Joe Cornish.
Joe. He went to South London to some of the youth groups to hang out with actual teens from, like, that area of South London. And some of the lines in the film are directly pulled.
Nice.
From things the kid said. So there's the line fucking Dimple says where she's like, I'm not touching that, you can have chlamydia. I don't want to get chlamydia. That's an actual line that a girl said.
Nice.
At the youth group. Same with, you better off calling Ghostbusters love. Also a line that he pulled directly from teens from South London. And I like that he did that, because it is really,
really lends the film an air of authenticity.
It does, because the great thing with this film is the kids sound like kids from that area. And I think that's something that's missing quite a lot with films like this, unless you are someone like, so like, I know adulthood and kidulthood do it, but that's again because it's made by people from that part of London. If you get somebody who's not from there, who's never really spent time there and hasn't bothered putting the time and effort into figuring out what the language is like.
Everyone
there.
Sounds like they're in fucking EastEnders.
Yeah, and the thing is, it does just ring true. Because especially, I feel like maybe not if you're not from England, but if you are British, like, you know that there is a specific South London dialect.
Yeah, but I find that in, like, different places as well. Like, kids in Portsmouth have, like, a way of speaking.
Yeah,
like, kids in Manchester.
But a lot,
like,
of
Leeds,
time
Liverpool.
When we get films set in London, in England, they're set in London.
Yeah.
And films like this quite regularly are set in South London.
Yeah.
And it's a very specific way of talking. And you can tell when people have bothered to put the time and effort into making sure that that is correct. It's like, on the rare occasion a film is set in, like, Yorkshire or Liverpool or something, you can always tell if somebody, as a British person, I'm going to say, I don't know about internationally, you can tell if someone's put the time and effort in to actually spend time there to learn.
Yeah.
Because England is a place of many accents.
Yeah, I will say, Blow Dry, the film that came out in the 90s.
Oh.
Josh Hartnett never stepped foot in fucking Yorkshire.
No, he's never even seen Yorkshire.
He's never even had a cup of Yorkshire tea. That fucking... I love Josh Hartnett. If you're a long-term listener, you know how much I love that man, respect that man, and would have sex with that man. However, his fucking Yorkshire accent
fucking
is
terrible.
One of the most atrocious crimes against cinema I've ever heard in my life.
But I think it's one of those weird things, because, like you said, like, a lot of people who aren't, especially people who aren't British, just in general, have this expectation of, you come to England, we all speak kind of like me and you, like, very RC, and quite posh.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of the reason I'm quite excited that a lot of my films have British cast members that are British-based, because... I do feel like a lot of times you kind of don't realise exactly how wide the, not just the way we talk, because obviously there's so many different accents. I don't speak like where I'm from at all. A few words will slip through every now and then, but it's very rare. I'll go Yorkshire.
I think as I've got older, the way I speak is more like 60% American, 40% English. Like, I use a lot of American terms more than English terms.
But I like that this film, because while we go through my month, there is going to be a lot of different locations and also a lot of different accents, because obviously one of the films I picked, I know full well, has got... I always forget his name. It's Lauren's brother. But he's from, like, Liverpool, I think. Mm. Their family are from, like, Liverpool or Birmingham.
Robert Sheehan.
No, not Robert Sheehan. He's Irish.
Do you know, there is one person from England who not a single other English person sounds like. And he doesn't even try and do accent work, really. Jason Statham. Jason Statham sounds like no other British person on Earth.
That is very true. That is very true.
And even when he tries to be American, he just sounds like Jason Statham.
With a bit of an American twang on the end.
All right, I'm Jason Statham. I'm going to punch that fucking shark. All right, I'm Jason Statham. I'm a fucking beekeeper. All right, I'm Jason Statham. I'm Rick Ford. He just sounds the fucking same in everything.
But to be fair, there's a few people like that. Where you're like, I've never heard another... Fucking What's-His-Face is a really good example of that. Sherlock.
Oh, Beeblebatch
Campbellbrick. Not Beeblebatch Campbellbrick.
Johnny Lee Miller.
Johnny Lee Miller is the only English person I know who sounds like they're American trying to put on an English accent.
Charlie Hunnam. We had this conversation
Charlie
yesterday.
Charlie Hunnam, yeah.
Charlie Hunnam in Green Street. Charlie Hunnam's from fucking Newcastle, bruv. He was in fucking Biker Grove.
Biker Grove.
And then he played Jax Teller for 10 years. And then,
annoying me now.
And then he's in Green Street. He's all like, oh, I've got up apples and pears for a fucking football fight with me mates, mush. And I'm like, oh, behave, you fucking lunatic.
It's really annoying me now. I can't think what the actor is called. It's Michael something, I swear. The guy from Double Date.
I don't fucking know. Dougie from McFly. He's
no,
in that
not
movie.
Dougie from Michael Soker. Michael Soker, that's his fucking name.
Is he the geezer from Being a Human?
He isn't Being Human, but his sister...
Is he also in Misfits as well?
No, his sister is in Misfits.
I thought he was like the big, tall, skinhead bloke, the white
guy.
You know the guy. I mean, though, the big, dopey looking...
Oh, he's from Derby.
Fucking hell. Derby.
Derby. Lauren, no, his sister, I want to say she's called Lauren. Lauren Soker? Mm. Is in Misfits.
Anyway...
Sorry, I'm really distracted.
So we've talked a lot about the kids. What do you think of the alien element of this film? Because
I fucking love the aliens.
Embarrassingly, I actually think that this movie is kind of what would happen if aliens did land on a council estate.
No, it definitely is, 100%. I love the aliens in this. So my first big thing with the aliens is I love the fact that we get a glimpse. We see the female of the race.
The little one, yeah.
The little white one. It's just an odd-looking, what the fuck is that puppet? Because that's not what it is. It's a puppet.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the males, because you don't really get a clear glimpse of the males until about a solid two-thirds of the way through this film.
Yeah.
Because it's shot mostly in the dark. You just see their teeth, which are very intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
Up until it crashes through into... Sam's apartment, pretty much, is the first time we get a clear view of what they actually look like.
The first time you see them reminds me of that scene in Finding Nemo, where there's, like, the little light and then the fish appears.
Oh, the, oh my God, what are they called? Anglerfish.
Yeah. Reminds me of that.
I can't with anglerfish anymore. I've been re-listening to the Magnus Archives and anglerfish now freak me out again. But no, like, I love the design. I think it was a really smart use of budget,
mm-hmm.
because this movie is practical.
Yeah.
Completely practical. I think there's maybe one or two CGI bits, but it
Well, the aliens are CGI, aren't they? They've got a CGI enhancement.
They've got a CGI enhancement, I think, but they are practical effects. Mm-hmm. I think maybe they would have, because of the colour of them and mm-hmm. how dark they actually are, because they're, like, black. They are the blackest black.
The devil's black. So to paraphrase Halloween.
The devil's black. But I do think the design of them is really fucking cool. And the fact they did a lot of it practically really lends this film quite a lot of... Everyone knows at this point how I feel about practical against CGI. I fucking love the use of practical effects. I think if you can do it practically, it should be done practically.
Yeah, this is an argument. Sorry, this is a weird tangent. This is an argument me and you had yesterday. So I watched the Flintstones movie again yesterday. And there are literally scenes in that movie where Dino is like CGI and a puppet. But they have him do really, really complicated shit as a puppet. And then they'll just have him walk through a room as CGI, often in the same scene. And I'm like, what is the fucking point? You've got the puppet there. You're making the puppet drink out of a toilet. Why can you not have the puppet just walk across the room?
Mm.
Like, every other fucking thing in this movie is practical. But and I showed you, didn't I? I showed you that scene where Dino runs in. He CGI, jumps, he's practical, and then he CGI, and then he's practical. So, yeah, like, completely agree. Practical effects, always.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, I love the island design. And I just think it's such a smart... Because they didn't really have a massive... Like, 13 million, realistically, for a film like this is not that much money.
No.
At all. And to use actual puppets was A, very smart, but B, to use it in a way that they didn't really have to show the whole thing for a massive chunk of the movie. And most of the time, bar the very end of the film, you only maybe see like one or two at a time, so they didn't have to have that many puppets. Yeah. They probably in total had maybe about five or six puppets of the aliens, and that was kind of
yeah,
it.
And then like the rest of them were maybe just plugged in with CGI.
Well, I feel like the group scene at the end, they just, yeah, basically what they'll have done is like, not, I don't want to say they CGI'd it in, but like replicated it.
Yeah, yeah.
Through it. Because I do know they use very minimal CGI in the film. Which, again, was probably a budgetary reason. But no, I think the design is really... I think it's potentially one of my favourite alien designs.
Yeah, and I think also there's, like, a couple of really cool set pieces where they show off, like... Like, there's that scene in the hallway in the apartment block when they're, like, shooting... Like, it's pitch black, and then they're shooting the fireworks, and then the aliens are, like, lit up by the fireworks. Like, you just see...
The shadows.
Like, the shadows in the fireworks and stuff like that is really, really cool. Like...
The way this film is shot... So, I've seen this film multiple times, but it's only in the last couple of years since we've been doing the podcast that I've really started looking at how films are actually shot.
Because you're welcome.
I still don't really care all that much, but I've started paying some kind of attention to it. But I think the way that they use the light and dark, and the fact that this is set on Guy Fawkes Night, on Bonfire Night, really fucking smart, because it means that they can set it in mostly pitch black, basically constantly, but have light flashes from fireworks going off, dickhead kids firing fireworks down a street. No one questions it. It's Bonfire Night in the UK. That's what fucking happens. And it's a really great way to light this film.
Mm-hmm. There's one scene in this that's kind of in... it kind of reminds me of Cloverfield. Have you ever seen Cloverfield?
No, babe.
So there's a scene in Cloverfield. It's set in New York where they go under the subway system. And obviously Cloverfield is a found footage film. And there's these like little parasite things. But it's all pitch black. And they put the night vision on the camera and you just see like there's like an attack. One of them gets attacked in the subway and all you see is like the little flashes of the alien attack and you get just enough glimpses that your brain just goes, what the fuck was that? And they do that quite a lot in this movie, like especially like at the beginning when they're like the kids are on the ledge on the tower block and you see it like walking down the street. And then she see like Sam's character sees it in the wing mirror, but you don't see what she sees in the wing mirror. Like she just sees it and she reacts. And I think to keep the budget down, but to kind of also put some tension into a film that is kind of like an absurd situation, there are some scenes in this that are actually quite tense. Like this movie's not particularly stressful, but there are a couple of scenes where you're just like, that's clearly a budgetary thing, but also, like, it works in your favour. Like, the Jaws effect. It works in your favour because you're trying to stick in a budget or you've not got the scope to...
For a massive chunk of this movie, the creatures are basically just shadows around in the background. Like, you'll see the movement.
Or the eyes and teeth.
Or the eyes and teeth, and that's kind of it. But, yeah, the scene in the police van... When they first pick up Moses, is super fucking tense. Because it's not just that as well. It's like after the cops die, the van is shaking and slamming about. It's really well done. And also, which what is the fucking kid's name?
Pest.
No, not... Oh, is it Pest? No, it's not Pest. It's not Pest.
Jerome? Nope. Dennis?
Nope. The other one.
Steve?
His name is not Steve. Biggs. Because basically, for most of this film, Biggs is not with the rest of the gang.
He's in a bin.
He's in a bin. With his mobile phone. He's only got a little bit of credit left, though, which is fucking cracking. But this sequence, because we don't really see it to begin with, but like where the bin starts shaking and he's like in the bin, we know it's directly outside and can hear him on the phone.
Yeah.
Is fucking great.
Yeah, and like that's really good use of like staying in budget but creating scenes that like you as an audience member can feel like, the tension of, because the police seat like truck scene and the bin scene, the camera's inside the thing with the characters, so it puts you in that situation with them as well, which I think is really interesting. Like whether it was done for budgetary reasons or whether it was done to kind of ramp up the horror a little bit, I think either way it's interesting and like it's incredibly effective. And it's like when you watch like Aliens or Alien or any of those like movies from that franchise, there's always those like couple of scenes where you can like hear something in the vents, or you like somebody's like hiding in something and they can only see it like a little bit and they don't really know where it is. And I think it's just, yeah, it's very well done. So yeah, I mean, I think it's effective, but then I always think like those kind of, I'm always kind of a big advocate of like show, don't tell.
Yeah, me too.
I guess we should probably like address the last elephant in the room before we get to our final thoughts on this movie.
There's an elephant in the room.
Yeah, it's over there.
Oh, I see it.
They've been talking about it for a couple of years. It was first announced in 2021, and John Boyega talked about it at the tail end of last year. They have announced that John Boyega and Joe Cornish are working on a sequel to this movie. It's meant to be happening. It's an active development. What are your thoughts on the sequel to this?
I'm very intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
Because part of me would like to know what happened next. Because part of me feels with like the length of time between them, there's a good chance that Moses did go to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps he didn't and he got out of the estate and... Or stayed in the estate. I mean, I don't fucking know. But I would love to know what happened after. But I am also intrigued as to how you replicate. Because I feel like they can't just have another alien invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, this is kind of like my problem. Like, there are some films that don't need to become franchises, or they don't need to have sequels. Like, it was announced earlier this week that there's rumours that they're going to make a Ready or Not 2. Mm. Like, Ready or Not is a very good self-contained film. It doesn't need a sequel. And I feel like this is exactly the same. Like, I don't feel like... And I'm not saying that for any reason other than, like, I just feel like... If you start adding lore to the aliens or start like adding this and adding that and adding, you know, it takes away from like the magic of like what this film is. And I think it's the same like Shaun of the Dead, don't need a sequel to it. World's End, don't need a sequel to it. Like
Hot Fuzz, though, we do need a sequel to it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. But like, you know, those films work because they are their own thing and they stand on their own thing and they've not had like, you know, that added extra thing to them to take them away from what they are. And I'm not saying all sequels are bad. Like, there are some films that are clearly designed to become franchises or to have sequels and have actually benefited from having more films in their series. As somebody who's just watched all of the Bad Boys movies, that definitely benefited from becoming a franchise. But like, I agree with you. I think they would have to pivot to something else. Like, I think they would have to maybe change the genre. Like, I think they would have to have, like... But then if you do zombies, it becomes a bit too much like Shaun of the Dead. If you do, like, a werewolf, like, thing, like, what do you pivot to? I mean, you could do Aliens again, but you'd have to have a bloody good reason for it. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And you'd have to do something that is as culturally significant and as interesting an idea now that fits in with today's culture and where we are now as to where we were like 13 years ago. And I think Joe Cornish and John Boyega are probably acutely aware of that. Like, John Boyega is an incredibly smart person. Like, if you ever watch him be interviewed, like, he's not out there doing, like, any old shit. Like, he puts his name on stuff that he cares about and he's passionate about. And I don't think, now that he's more famous than he was back then, I don't think he would be willing to put his name on something that's, like, a cheap cash grab. But then again, he was in Star Wars, so maybe.
Yeah, I think the thing is, though, is, like, this was the film that started his career, realistically.
Yeah.
This is the film that kind of got his name out there. And also, from everything I've ever read, he really loves this film. Like, he's very proud of the fact he made this movie. So I can't see him willingly signing on and going forward with a sequel if he doesn't feel like the story is worth telling.
Yeah. I have to ask, though, would you rather have a sequel film or a sequel series? Would you rather have, like, a film that's, like, an hour and 40 minutes, 2 hours like this? Or would you rather have someone like Netflix pick it up for, like, a six episode series? Because I do think if you have to expand the world, maybe a TV series is the way to go, because then that way you can kind of expand upon the actual characters and their lives, and like, if you are going to come back so many years later.
I agree with you to a degree, but I also feel like the reason this movie works so much is because we're only given small glimpses at what everyone's life looks like. We don't know the intricate details. We don't know the ins and outs. We don't know them intimately.
Yeah.
We just have a very partial view of what these people, who they are and what they look like and what their lives look like. And I think that's part of the reason this film works so much, because you are given two opposing sides of a character.
Yeah.
With this, you are given the very best versions of them and probably the worst versions of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the middle ground of somewhere that sits. Yeah. And I feel like digging any further into the characters and giving any more lore or backstory to them kind of takes away from them quite a lot.
I also think, though, like, part of me is less, I'm less interested in them doing like the Aliens version of this, where they go bigger on the alien lore, more aliens, more creatures, more different types of creatures. What I'm interested in is them doing like the Wet Hot American Summer, like 10 years later version of this, where it's like, okay, so what happens to the estate kids when they become adults? Like, how did this experience change them? Did they get out of the estate? Did their lives change in any fundamental way? Did they go on to become like different people? Like, did they move away? Did they, like, where did they go? Or, you know, ultimately,
did
like,
Sam start delivering casseroles on a weekly basis to like, Moses?
But like, did they stay in the estate? Like, have they had the next generation of estate kids? Like, what are their lives like now as parents? Like, have they learnt from the mistakes of their parents? Like, I'm more interested in where these characters ended up and the people that they became, and then how something like this would affect them now, rather than them going the other route like they normally do with sequels like this, where they're like, well, we had this type of creature in the first one, so, well, we're going to introduce like three or four different types of creatures. There's going to be more action. There's going to be more this. There's going to be more that.
Yeah, I do feel like...
And there is, I think, a middle ground there of telling both of those stories, but
I do feel like with a film like this, because I do feel like the aliens could be interchanged with anything. Yeah. I feel like the core important thing of this film is the social commentary. Not so much the aliens. I do feel like the aliens were like, we need a protagonist in the film to give it kind of a more fantastical element and to kind of take the edge off to a degree.
Yeah.
Because it is quite a political film. It's a very like social economic film. And I feel like if they were going to do a sequel, it would be less about, you know, extending the alien lore and more of a, like, we have something to say about the current social climate.
Yeah.
We're going to say those things, but there will be an alien element because we want it to still be, we don't want to just be like shoving a message down your throat. We want something there for people to also take away from it of it being a fun film while also mm-hmm. being given the information of like what the social climate is like mm-hmm. for these people.
I also would be fascinated to kind of know how much of like today's political climate would be put into a film. Like, how do you tell this story in a post-Brexit, post-COVID world mm. where like the estate people and the lower classes have become even more disenfranchised because like their estates and their homes and their families have been ravaged by things like, you know, COVID and like the political climate and things like that, like
yeah, cost of living, like, everything, you know, like that, you know, yeah.
What does like setting a story like this in today's social climate, you know, where things are even more difficult than they were back then, you know, where does that story kind of take place and what does that kind of like lead into? Mm. I think there are some interesting ideas, especially if you do pick up, especially if you can get all the actors back and you do pick up with like the kids that did survive. And, like, the other characters, like, you know, what did become of Sam? Like, what did become of Bruce? What did become of Ron? Like, what did become of Moses and Pest? And, like, you know, what did Probs of Mayhem go on to do? Like, did Probs of Mayhem, like, learn anything from this experience? Did they go down a different path? Like, did they become a fucking shit DJ crew? Like, you know, who knows? Like,
wait, did they become Rizzle Kicks?
did they become Chase and Status? Like, but you know what I mean? Like, I would be fascinated to know more what happened to the characters rather than what they're going to fight this time around, mm. like, to me. I think that probably concludes the episode. But, like, what are your final thoughts on this movie and, like, what is your final score for this film?
Honestly, I love this film.
Okay.
I really do. I loved the first time I watched it. I still love it now. I think it's a great film. I think they do a really good job of, I'm going to call it hiding social commentary within an alien invasion movie. Because, let's be realistic, a lot of people don't want to hear the social commentary around stuff like this. They have zero interest. They don't want to go to the cinema and see it. And I think putting it inside an alien invasion movie and kind of, I don't want to say hiding because I feel like that's a bit sneaky, but kind of for giving it to you in small doses whilst it being still a fun action-packed film is really fucking smart
mm-hmm.
and probably got a lot of people who probably wouldn't have watched this film otherwise to go see it. And I just think it's great. I think the cast are fantastic. I love all of the kids. I think the kids are great. I say kids. I don't know how old they are because John Boyega's my age.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling they're all approximately my age-ish. But I think they're all really good. They sell it really well as well. They do such a good job of like being very believable. I don't know if any of the kids were actually from South London.
John Boyega is. He was born in Camberwell.
I know John Boyega was, but the rest of them, babe. Mm. I think Jodie Whittaker's a delight. I always think Jodie Whittaker's a delight. Nick Frost is great. I couldn't think of no one else I would have cast in this movie to play that part either. I was like, that was specifically written with Nick Frost in mind. I really, really, really like Bruce or whatever his name is.
Bruce.
I think Bruce is funny.
He's a prick.
He's a prick. I just think he's really amusing because he's such an out of place character.
Yeah.
And I think having him there is a really smart choice as well. I don't know what it is about him, but I'm like, it makes sense for him to be there.
Yeah.
Even though it makes zero fucking sense for him to be there, it makes so much sense that he's involved in
this. Yeah.
I fucking despise Hi-Hat.
Yeah, I think he's a...
So the guy who played him, fucking banging job, because I hate him so fucking much. He's a prick. But I think it's really fun. I just think it's quite an enjoyable movie. I'm like, yeah, it does address some, like, you know, pretty big and quite difficult subjects, but I do honestly all in all think it's just a really fucking fun film.
Yeah.
And I like watching it, and therefore I'm gonna give it 5, you know,
mate. This ain't Letterboxd, motherfucker.
I'm gonna give it 5 axes. or whatever it is we're using now.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen this movie in a long time, and I fucking hated it the first couple of times I saw it. My opinion has slightly softened on it, because I do think that the social commentary, and I do think that the aspects of storytelling have aged incredibly well, especially with the things that are going on in this country nowadays. I think those things are always going to be prevalent, and I think because of that, this film does age incredibly well. Like, this film will never age poorly. Like, we'll never look back on this film and go, do you remember that time in history when, like, London was like this? Because I think there's some aspect of it that's always going to be like that, which is always going to keep this film relevant. I enjoy the alien stuff. I still don't really like the characters. I do find that the characters, for the most part, to be quite insufferable. But I think that's just their characterization and their language. Like, I just don't like the way that teenagers like that talk, says the old man who yells at Cloud and calls everybody dude and man.
Although you do use Merc after watching this film.
Yeah, I do quite a lot. But I think the characterization of the kids is good. Like, I do think it is interesting how they kind of do make them, like, heroic and sympathetic while also, like, maintaining the elements of them. Like, they never go full tilt and try and change them too much. They just go, look, you know, just because they're rough kids from an estate who've caused crime doesn't mean that they can't do the right thing when it comes to it. But I just find them insufferable the way they talk. I love the alien stuff, and the alien stuff is great. The alien design is great. The way that they're used, the way that they're deployed is great. I think the performances are good. And I have softened quite a lot in this film. I think I'm going to give it a 3 overall. I don't quite think it's the slam dunk that everybody thinks that it is. But I do think it's, like, a fairly entertaining film that has aged quite well. So, yeah, that's my final thoughts on this film, and that's my score. As always, guys, thank you so much for your continued support. Join us on Friday, where we will be doing our 5x5 for the month, where we will be looking at our top 5 horror villains that we root for. We will also be back next Monday with a look at the David Tennant, Robert Sheehan starring Bad Samaritan, which will be our film for next week. As always, guys, you can find us on social media. We are on X/Twitter at SIMAHFpod. So I'm Married a Horror Fan, all lowercase, all one word, on Tumblr and Instagram. If you want to follow us independently on Letterboxd, we are both now on Letterboxd, so you can come and join the chaos there. I am Zombie_Simon on Letterboxd, and Lee is whatever your Instagram name is.
Yeah, so it's Leighton Lawley, but it's just minus the _13 at the end. So
there you go.
The first part of my Instagram name.
So you can join us for some chaotic, unhinged takes on Letterboxd. We also have an archive of every episode that we've ever done on there, like, film-wise. I am currently in the process of putting all of, like, my star ratings on there, so you can kind of see what we did. But I am archiving it on there, so if you wanted to, rather than scrolling through, like, our social media, you can just go to my Letterboxd and see the list of all the films that we've covered. And then that'll give you an indication chronologically of where we covered something. As always, you know, we just want you guys to stay spooky, stay safe. And because of the algorithms fucking us over at the moment, if you do like what you see and you want to follow us for more, make sure any social media that you're following us on, get the notifications on, and make sure you get notifications on your streaming platform so you can be notified of when new episodes dropped, because I think everybody's feeling the algorithmic pinch at the moment. So yeah, as always, guys, stay spooky, stay safe, take care, bye-bye.